I wanted to speak about Purim. Obviously, we're a little over a week away, and usually this time of year we have a special Purim shiur. And I was thinking about various themes which I think are essential to the holiday of Purim. I generally am attracted to, especially for a shiur like this, not topics which are more on the periphery, but things which are really relate to the essence of a mitzvah, or the essence in this case of a holiday. And in order to kind of flesh out the point which I wanted to discuss this evening, I want to begin by asking three questions, three very basic questions, but I think they will be a good springboard for the discussion and the more in-depth study that I'd like to have. So the first question is based on something that you probably all familiar with, but it's actually because we're so familiar with it, we may take it for granted. And that is the fact that of all of the books of Tanakh, the Megillah never mentions Hashem's name. It's something that's well known. We speak about it a lot, but if you think about it, it's really bizarre. You know, okay, it's true that there's a tradition that when it says HaMelech, that's referring to Hashem versus just Melech, that's Achashverosh. And it's also true that the more mystical thinkers, such as the Arizal, are quoted as saying that in various psukim, if you take the first letter of each word, four letters in a row, you can spell out Yud Kei Vav Kei, and in other words, you spell Yud Kei Vav Kei backwards. And I'm not questioning any of that. I'm not skeptical. I'm not doubting any of that. But it would seem to me that at least initially we should acknowledge that it's all besides the point. Why should it be? Why is it that Hashem's name is not at all in the Megillah? Even if we were to postulate that Mordechai and Esther just decided to write, you know, a historical fiction, or even actually a nonfiction work, however you'd want to describe it, but, you know, just on their own, we would think that they would mention Hashem. But given the fact that this is written Baruch HaKodesh, it's part of Tanakh, it is really peculiar, and I think needs to be understood. That's question number one. Question number two is based on the Gemara in Masechet Megillah, on Daf Vav Amud Bet. The Gemara notes, as we all know, that there is no Hallel that is said on the holiday of Purim. There is almost no other holiday which is similar to this. This is in and of itself unique, and that's not my question. My question really relates to the Gemara, because the Gemara itself, you know, wonders why should it be? Not only do all the Daraisa holidays have Hallel, but even Hanukkah has Hallel. Why? Right, so we know there's an issue, half Hallel, whole Hallel, but why would Purim be the only holiday that has no Hallel? And the Gemara gives different answers. Perhaps it relates to the fact that this is the only story which takes place primarily outside of Eretz Yisrael. Perhaps the fact that even at the end of the story, Akate Avde Achashverosh Anan, you know, we are happy the story ends on a high note, but it's not as celebratory as one might think, right? The Jews won, but they were still servants to Achashverosh. They were not free, and they certainly didn't rebuild the Beis HaMikdash for quite a few years afterwards. But what I want to focus on actually is the third answer that is given in the Gemara. The Gemara gave three answers to the question, and that just goes to show you how good the question is, right? None of the answers seem to be good enough, which is why we have multiple answers. Just think about it, Lahavdil, whenever you're learning, think about whenever you ask your child something. If they have to give too many explanations for what they did or didn't do, your question is better than any of their answers, right? That's just, it's human nature, and it's true in learning as well. If one answer was good enough, you wouldn't need three. So when the Gemara or any source you're reading, it could be in Chumash or Gemara, doesn't matter. Once they start giving multiple answers, you know that there must be something less than perfect with any of the answers. But of the three answers that's given, I want to focus on a third, which I haven't mentioned yet. And that is that the Gemara says that actually the premise in a certain way is wrong. The idea of Hallel, the idea of celebrating and praising Hashem, that is usually the theme of Hallel, we do find it in the holiday of Purim, says the Gemara according to this answer. How so? Kriyusa zu hilula. That the reading of the Megillah, Kriyusa, the reading of the Megillah, is itself a form of Hallel. Now, what exactly that means, in what way exactly is the Megillah an expression of Hallel? That is a very interesting question, but not one that I want to focus on. I want to, you know, I guess the theme of mine, I guess you could say for all three of these questions is, I'm trying to be as simple as possible. Let's not try to overthink things, at least not tonight. Simple. Not how is Megillah reading a form of Hallel. Let's stipulate, if the Gemara said it, it must be true, and presumably the Rishonim, the Mefarshim, work out the details, the mechanics of how that's so. Fine. But I have a much more basic question. Why should it be so? If you tell me there's no Hallel, so I have a simple question, why is there no Hallel? But once you're telling me, according to this answer, that even Purim requires Hallel, despite the fact that the holiday took place in Persia and not in Eretz Yisrael, despite the fact that we end off the Megillah still servants of Achashverosh, according to this answer, Purim is still worthy of a Hallel. But we fulfill the Hallel through the Megillah. Why? Why? Once you're telling me that we have Hallel, why not just say Hallel? Right, so we have that's two questions, right? Number one is, why no Shem Hashem? Number two is, if you assume that Purim needs Hallel, why are we somehow surreptitiously embedding it somehow into the Megillah? Yay, we did two mitzvahs, Megillah and Hallel. We're too tired, we don't have time, we're lazy. If you think you should say Hallel, then just say Hallel. Why are we connecting it to the Megillah? That's question number two. And question number three is a little bit, it'll take a little bit, not complicated, but a little bit more evolved to unpack. But this is, again, one of the important sources when it comes to the holiday of Purim. And it's the famous Gemara, which actually connects in many ways Purim to the holiday of Shavuos. And that is the Gemara Masechta Shabbos and Daf Peches that describes the giving of the Torah. And this is the Gemara that is a very important Shavuos Gemara, because this is the Gemara that tells us that notwithstanding the fact that we read in Parshas Mishpatim that the Jewish people voluntarily accepted the Torah, Na'aseh v'nishma, even on blind faith, they said we'll do it, no problem. But according to the Gemara, very famously, there was a significant amount of coercion which occurred and evidently was necessary in the giving of the Torah. Says the Gemara that when the Torah says that they were standing at the foot of the mountain, Yitziatzvu b'tachtidahar, you can read that not at the foot, but underneath the mountain. Says the Gemara, Hashem, as it were, lifted up the mountain, held it over their head, and basically said, I'm going to make you an offer you can't refuse. Either accept the Torah, or here will be your burial. Right? Take it or leave it. Now, it's a very interesting and important question whether we should take a Gemara like this literally. Did Hashem really lift up the mountain over their head? Is it somehow more of a metaphor for, and it doesn't mean it literally? Interesting question. But one thing's for sure, the Gemara is telling us that there was coercion at the time of Har Sinai. Now, you may be wondering, why did Hashem need to coerce the Jewish people if the Torah itself testifies, Na'aseh v'nishma, they already volunteered? That's a great question. The Medrash asks that question. Rishonim asks that question. Mirtz Hashem, that could be a Shavuah shir for us. Not for now. But the Gemara accepts the fact that yes, there was an element of coercion. And yes, according to the Gemara, that actually in some way takes away from the, you know, the significance and the efficacy and obligatory nature of Har Sinai. Says the Gemara, Mikan, the Jewish people had a modah rabba lo raisa. The Jewish people basically always had an excuse. Whenever they weren't behaving, they could say, listen, Hashem, we never really agreed to this. You kind of forced us into it. So, we're not doing everything we're supposed to, but it's not like we ever really agreed. You forced us. Says the Gemara, amazingly, this phenomenon that the Jewish people were obligated, but really Hashem had twisted their arm and they kind of always had an excuse, says the Gemara, that lasted until the Purim miracle, until the Purim story. Says the Gemara, after the great salvation of Purim, Hadr Kibluha Bimei Achashverosh. The Jewish people, once again, and this time totally volitionally, totally out of their free will, reaccepted with a fuller and complete heart the Torah. As the Pasuk in the Megillah says, Kimu v'Kiblu, right? They upheld and they accepted, and the Gemara darshins in a play on words, kimu mashikiblu kfar. They accepted what they had already accepted. And the Gemara explains, again, that means that yes, they accepted the Torah back at the time of Har Sinai, but it was a little bit coerced, and because of that, there was an upgrade. Amazingly, Purim is an upgrade over Shavuos. There they had a little level of coercion, says the Gemara. Here there was no coercion at all. Hadr kibluha, they accepted it totally out of love, out of free will, out of loyal devotion to Hashem. So given all of that, deep breath, my third question, once again, I hope, is quite simple, which is, what about the Purim story inspired them to all of a sudden re-accept the Torah with a full and complete heart? Yes, Hashem saved them. Yes, Hashem had done a miracle for them. But there's no way, and in fact we know it's the case, it wasn't exactly the first miracle Hashem had done for them since Har Sinai. Right? A lot had happened since then. They went through the desert 40 years. They entered and conquered the land of Israel. They had the first Beis HaMikdash and everything that was going on then. All of that happened before Purim. And yet for some reason they never re-accepted the Torah. Then comes along the Purim miracle, Hadar Kibluha B'Yemei Achashverosh. What happened then? What was so significant about what happened then? So let's review. We asked three questions, and I would maintain that all three of them are very simple questions. But I think, like in many areas of life, sometimes the simplest are the sharpest. And I think they require really, not fancy footwork, but a good and deep understanding and an answer. Right? Our first question is, number one, how come Hashem's name is not explicitly mentioned in the Megillah? I think sometimes people, whether it's Svarim or people like you and me, we get so focused on all the clever, encoded ways that we can find Hashem's name alluded in the Megillah that we are missing the question which is kind of staring us in the face. Why would it be that way? Why not have Hashem's name in a book in the Tanakh written with Ruach HaKodesh? Number two, we asked, according to the opinion that Purim deserves and merits and necessitates a Hallel, why is it that according to that opinion, we say that reading the Megillah suffices? If you tell me that we don't need Hallel for some technical reason, okay, Beseder. But once you tell me you're supposed to say Hallel on Purim, why not just say it? Why bail out, as it were, and just rely on the Megillah? And number three, if it's true that the Jewish people reaccepted the Torah out of love and free will on Purim, why? What happened all of a sudden at Purim? What changed things? Why all of a sudden then, as opposed to at any time previously? Those are our three questions. In order to answer all of these questions, what I'd like to do is try to suggest to you, based on numerous sources, what I think is in many ways the heart of and the essence of the holiday of Purim. And to do that, I want to share with you another halacha. It's a halacha that is not relevant this year, and I'm not enough of a calendar buff to be able to, I don't remember the last time, but it wasn't that long ago, and I can't tell you, since I'm not a calendar buff, when the next time will be. But we do know that there's a phenomenon in Jewish life that sometimes there is a leap year. Sometimes there is a second Adar, right? So why? What are the mysteries of the calendar? It's mathematical, it's scientific, it's over my head. Whatever the Luach says, that's what I do. I'm a very simple Jew when it comes to calendar things. Luckily, we have some good Gabayim in the shul, and they help me out. But the Gemara in Masech the Megillah wants to know a very important question, which is, if there are going to be two Adars, which Adar should Purim be in? Which one? I'm not going to embarrass anyone to ask if you remember from year to year which one it is. It's one of those things I find like all sorts of, sometimes even with my own students, I'll be talking about the laws of the Seder or something. And I'll be like, so what does your family do? And all of a sudden, like these smart guys, like, if I ask them some razzle dazzle question, that they could answer on the spot. But like remembering what we do from year to year sometimes is easy to forget. So the Gemara itself asks the question, which one should we do? Before I get to the conclusion. But the Gemara offers a good argument for both. The argument to have Purim in the first Adar is that we usually have a rule in Halacha that if we have an opportunity to do a mitzvah, we don't bypass it. Right? We always try to take the first opportunity to do the mitzvah. Right? Ein ma'avir na'ala mitzvah. So if I have an opportunity to do Purim, why would I wait a month to do it? And that's a very tried and true rule. On the other hand, the Gemara has a very fascinating suggestion, and that is that perhaps we should dafka delay and have Purim in the second Adar so that we can be mismach geula legeula, so that we can bring the two geulas closer together. We can have Purim, which was a geula, it was a salvation, a redemption from Achashverosh, and we could have that just, you know, a short while before, right abutting up next to, juxtaposed to Pesach. If we have it in the second Adar, Adar will be right before Nisan, which it is in a normal year. If we have Purim in the first Adar, on the one hand, we're doing it at the first opportunity, but on the other hand, then we have this huge gap and a whole second Adar with no Purim, and that's, so to speak, interrupting the thematic flow of Purim into Pesach. That's the different arguments that are suggested in the Gemara. And in fact, the halach is, and what is our conclusion? We actually have Purim always in the second Adar. The second Adar. This answer that's given in the Gemara of mismach geula legeula, that it's important to juxtapose the redemption, the liberation, the salvation in the time of Achashverosh with the redemption and the salvation from Paro and Yetziat Mitzrayim, that argument is considered dispositive. That's the argument that wins the day. And in fact, we have Purim in the second Adar. The question is, on a deeper level, what message is it trying to convey? According to that first answer, which we don't go with, that's a technical thing. Always do mitzvos early as possible. And there's a very deep, I think, reasonable and beautiful spiritual message embedded in that. But even if we would have paskin that way, we don't. But even if we would have paskin that way, that's not a unique Purim message. That's true by lots of mitzvos. Evidently, the reason that we end up choosing the second Adar for Purim is because there's something more important about the message of being mismach geula legeula. We want to have some connection, to create a connection between Purim and Pesach. Or let me restate it this way. The fact that Purim is in Adar and Pesach is in Nisan could easily be assumed to be a coincidence. Right? They happened at very different points in history. It happens to be we went out of Mitzrayim in Nisan. It happens to be that the lottery of Haman fell out in Adar and the eventual victory happened in Adar, and those months are next to each other. You know, but if something in your personal life or in your family, you know, many, many moons ago, you know, took place in Adar, and then, you know, 25 years later, you know, I don't know, you had the birth of a child or a grandchild in Nisan, I don't think you would think that there's necessarily a connection between the events. They just happened to be, in, you know, a month apart. Yet you see from this Gemara that even though that might be reasonable, it's wrong. Apparently, according to this reason, which we paskin like, it's very important that Purim be right up against and as close as possible to Pesach, ad kerekach, to the extent that even though we have a very good argument in a leap year of creating a barrier between them and having Purim in the first Adar, no, we can't have that. We need to have Purim coming right before and leading into Pesach. And the question is why? I never would have thought there's a connection. What in the world, thousands of years apart, one from the other, what's the difference that one happened to be in Nisan, one happened to be in Adar? Yet you see from the Gemara, it's important to connect them. So in the very important and incredible Hasidic, early Hasidic Sefer, known as the B'nai Yisaschar, he has the following answer, and I think this is really sets the tone and is the key to really understanding a huge part of what Purim is about, and eventually will get us back to the three questions that we started with. And the B'nai Yisaschar speaks about the nature of miracles, of Nisim, how Hashem interacts in the world. And if I recall correctly, unless I missed it, I don't think that he quoted Ramban explicitly, but he's undoubtedly working off of an idea that the Ramban made famous in his commentary to the Torah from just a few weeks ago at the end of Parshas Bo. The commentary of the Ramban ala Torah, the very, very lengthy piece there at the end of Parshas Bo, speaks about tefillin, the Torah connects tefillin to remembering Yitzhak Mitzrayim. And like, what in the world does tefillin have to do with Yitzhak Mitzrayim? The Torah does the same thing for mezuzah. What does mezuzah have to do with Yitzhak Mitzrayim? And the Ramban uses that as an opportunity to not only explain the role of Yitzhak Mitzrayim, why basically we seem as a religion to be obsessed with Yitzhak Mitzrayim, and we try to remember it not only on Pesach and on Sukkot, which historically are about the Exodus and the story of leaving Egypt and our freedom, but even all sorts of other mitzvos and other times during the Jewish life cycle that don't seem to have any connection calendarically to those events or historically. So the Ramban, not only did he discuss the importance of Yitzhak Mitzrayim, he then actually broadens the discussion even more. He says, really, you can only appreciate Yitzhak Mitzrayim if you understand really the broader role of miracles. Miracles. Says the Ramban, something which I think by now many of us know, we may even take it for granted. And the truth is many, many thinkers and writers speak about this. But if I'm not mistaken, this is really a chidush of Ramban, or certainly Ramban is the earliest one to really give this a significant, prominent place in his overall hashkafa and his overall way of viewing the world and viewing Yiddishkeit. Says the Ramban as follows, Hashem interacts with the world in one of two ways. Sometimes Hashem interacts with the world in the way that you and I call a miracle. And that is what the Ramban refers to as a nes nigle, meaning it's obvious, it's apparent that it's a miracle. How so? Because it's Hashem stepping into and breaking the laws of nature, right? We're used to water working one way. All of a sudden came Kriya Yamsuf, and the water splits and stands up and then miraculously comes back on the Egyptians. We're used to, you know, also, you know, fire and ice are not supposed to be able to fall simultaneously from the heavens, you know, and just kill the Egyptians or ruin their crops. All sorts of miracles that took place during the Yitzhak Mitzrayim story. And not only then, but certainly that's maybe the most extreme example in all of history. Wow, that's amazing. Hashem can break of the laws of nature and do this incredible, incredible miracle in order, you know, to help us, and in that case, to liberate us from Mitzrayim. However, says Ramban, there's a second kind of miracle. And here he pens a very famous phrase, which again has been adopted by many. But if I'm not mistaken, I believe he is the author of this phrase, Nes Nistar, a hidden miracle. Says there are, now, and when he says a hidden miracle, he doesn't necessarily mean, you know, the kind of thing you read about in Mishpacha magazine, or you hear about waiting online, you know, at the grocery store, some incredible, insane coincidence. I'm not saying those aren't. I don't know. But he's talking about something much more regular and much more basic. And that is, if a nes nigle is when Hashem breaks the laws of nature, nes nistar is the laws of nature themselves. The very fact that the earth can spin on its axis, that we don't all fly off into outer space because there's gravity or other laws of science that are keeping us alive. The very fact that you can hear my voice through the miracles of science and technology. The very fact that I have a voice, that my brain is telling my mouth to say things, it's coming out. I can see you, you can see me. I mean, the millions and millions of things that have to go right for any human being to be fully healthy, let alone the world, the universe, etc., etc., the sun rising, the sun setting, the tides, all of those things, says the Ramban, we take them for granted for one simple reason. Because they occur repeatedly and predictably. But other than that, there's nothing less awesome and amazing about any of the things I just mentioned than Kriyas Yam Suf. It's just that the more regular and the more predictable something is, the less wowed we are by it. And the truth is, that's just, you know, human nature. You know, there is something really positive about consistency and good habits. But the flip side is, then things get, you know, taken for granted. I'll just give a simple mashal, right? I won't say there are two types of wives, because I could be getting myself in trouble. And not only with the woman who's on the bottom of my screen at the moment. But there are two types of husbands. Now, I might be getting myself in trouble too, but at least I'm not saying anything bad about anybody else, right? There are certain husbands who may regularly say, I love you, right? Now, I assume that that's appreciated. But it could also, at some point, just be like, you know, have a good day, so to speak. Oh, my daughter is also listening. Well, she's a Kala, so we'll find out soon enough, Bezrat Hashem, what kind of husband she'll have. I don't even know which one she wants. We haven't had that conversation. Eliana, should we talk about that now on a Zoom with some of your nearest and dearest friends? No, she doesn't. Yeah, not a good idea. Okay. Anyway, so the more regularly a person would say that, a husband would say that, right? Again, I assume there's a lot of benefits to that, but at some point, you know, it wouldn't be like, wow, when the 700th time in a row that he said it. On the other hand, you have other husbands who may not say it that often, and then boom, out of nowhere, for some reason, says to his wife, I love you. Right? So certainly you're going to notice it. It'll be like, amazing, wow, you said I love you. So which one's more amazing? So it depends on your perspective. Says the Ramban, the only difference about the Nais and Nistar is just that it happens all the time. The sun keeps on rising. Our voices keep on working, Bli Ayin Hara. Our eyes keep on working, Bli Ayin Hara. So, okay, we take it for granted. But it's just as amazing. We're just used to it, so we don't get impressed by it. Says Ramban, he goes one step further. It's not only that Nais Nistar is a Nais, and that it's worthy of appreciating Hashem, even when he does things regularly and predictably. Here's the key point, and we're about to get back to Purim in a moment. Says the Ramban there in Parshas Bo, of the two miracles, you know which one is the main one? Nais Nistar. Nais Nistar. You want that husband who says, I love you regularly. The regular, repeated, predictable mitzvos, nisim and miracles, that's the main way Hashem interacts in the world and shows his love for us. Every now and then he does something amazing out of the ordinary, I should say. But the ordinary amazing is actually the Ikar, says Ramban. In fact, he goes so far, it's such a radical paradigm shift from what we're used to. Says the Ramban, the reason that we have the occasional moments in history of a Nais Nigla is in fact just to remind you that Hashem is in control and is really the author and the architect of all of the Nisim Nistarim. But it's always the regular and predictable day-to-day miracles, which are the main ones. Okay, this is incredibly important, Hashkafa 101 of the Ramban in general. Now, with that background in mind, let's go back to Purim and the fact that in the Gemara we were discussing, Purim and Pesach apparently are connected, right? It's very important for the Gemara that Purim always be right next to Pesach. Mismach Geula LeGeula. So says the Bnei Yisachar, the famous Dinever as he's known, great, one of the great early Hasidic leaders and thinkers. What's going on here? Very simple. Pesach is example par excellence of a Nais Nigla, as we already mentioned, and the Ramban spoke about. That's what the Ramban says. Why is Yitziat Mitzrayim so important? Because it demonstrates Hashem's ability to just play with nature like anything. Hashem is just the master of everything. He could do what he wants when he wants. Pesach is the proof of that. So Pesach is the classic example, the paradigm of a Nais Nigla, Hashem breaking the laws of nature. He could do whatever he wants. He's the boss. What's Purim? Says the Bnei Yisachar, Purim is the paradigm of Nais Nistar. That is the example par excellence of the hidden miracle. After all, we know you could easily read and experience the entire Purim story and explain it all based on chance, or if you prefer, palace intrigue, politics. Mordechai is a great Machiavellian political mover and shaker. He puts Esther in the right place. She's a great strategist. She steps up at the moment of, you know, she becomes incredible in Perek Dalet. She becomes this incredible person. She's meek the first three Prakim. And then in Perek Dalet, she, you know, puts on her cape and Esther becomes Superwoman and she starts ordering everyone around and changing it. Right? You can explain it all without making any reference to Hashem. There's no overt miracles anywhere in the Purim story. In fact, there have been, if I'm not mistaken, I'm aware of at least two books that have been written all about political analysis of Megillas Esther and all the lessons you can learn about leadership and politics and strategy. Right? And it's all there for sure. Now, I'm not saying that those authors of those particular books don't believe that it's from Hashem either. That's a separate point. I certainly hope they do. But Obviously, we believe it's all from Hashem. But says the Bnei Yisachar, the way Hashem chose to operate in Purim is completely different, obviously, the way Hashem chose to operate during Pesach and Yetzias Mitzrayim. Pesach is a perfect example, the best example of an Nes Nigla. Purim is the perfect and ideal example of the Nes Nistar. And therefore, says the Bnei Yisachar, I'll read you just one or two lines because his language is so beautiful. What do you see from this? Hikpidu Chazal. It was very important to the Chachamim. Lekavoa hayom tov hazeh ba'adar hasamoch leNisan. Why? As the Gemara had said, we want to connect, we want to juxtapose the two geulos. That is to say, hainu lismoch inyan hashgacha v'geula hanisteret legeula haniglet. We want to connect the geula that occurred through quiet, hidden, diplomatic channels. Of course, we believe Hashem is pulling the strings on it all, but it happened in a hidden way. We want to juxtapose that to the geula that occurred in the most obvious and revealed way. Even though we know Echad Baran, Yotzer Echad Yitzran, it's the same author, it's the same conductor. It was Hashem in both, but Hashem chose to do it in different ways. Now, this idea, which I think is really a beautiful explanation of that idea, so whenever we have another leap year, we'll remind ourselves of this idea and it'll enrich that experience in that year. But let's zoom out now to the broader point. The broader point where we are now in our shiur is, I want to use for the rest of the shiur now, is this principle, this yesod, that Purim is the example par excellence of Hashem's interaction in the world in the way of Nistar. This is the way Hashem interacts with us just as effectively, just as powerfully, and just as directly, but in a hidden way. And as the Ramban said, it is the basis of our emunah that Hashem interacts with us this way. Right? We would have almost zero relationship with Hashem, especially in our generation, if we only believed in Anes Nigla. We could believe in it, but when's the last time one happened? Says the Ramban, no, you have to realize that for most of human history, Hashem will interact with the world through Anes Nistar. And the best example on a national level of that was Purim. And one of the main points, we cannot just go through Purim, we have to make sure the Purim goes through us. One of the main points of Emunah that we have to focus on every year in Purim is that a theme of Purim is being mechazik our Emunah in Nes Nistar. And the idea of Hashem's interaction, you're reading the Jerusalem Post, Times of Israel, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, whatever it is you're getting your news, you're seeing world events, you know, politics, elections, wars, all the big things, corona, all these things. We don't always know how to decode what Hashem is telling us, but we have to have a belief that it's all from Hashem, that Hashem is orchestrating everything just as much as he did at Kriyas Yamsuf. That's the belief of Nes Nistar, of Hashem's quiet, more hidden hashkacha. If that is the goal or one of the main themes of Purim, so let's go back now to the three questions we started with. And I think you'll see that they all are easily understood now. What was the first question we asked? Why is Hashem not explicit in the Megillah? It's the only book in Tanakh like this. Why? And now we see the answer is perfect. Because that's the whole point of the Megillah. To be able to see Hashem even when you don't see Hashem. To be able to realize that when the Megillah says HaMelech, it means HaMelech, capital Hey. That's exactly the point. It's perfect. It's not. It is idiosyncratic. It's enough to grab our attention. But it's not a mystery. It's curious, but it's not a mystery. It's curious in a way we can easily understand. Because now that we realize that the whole theme of the holiday and of the Megillah is being mechazik our belief in Nes Nistar, what better way to communicate that than to hide Hashem's name? Just as Hashem is in the Megillah, even though his name is not there, we're reminded that Hashem is interacting with us and certainly on the world stage, even when it's not as obvious as we might have liked or it has been at other points in history. Question number two. We said, if you say that you need Hallel, so how come we're relying on the Megillah? Why not just come out and say it? So this is a question that I saw that the great Rav Usher Weiss asks, in his book Minchas Asher, in the Sichot, as he calls them, on the holiday of Purim. And he says exactly the point, you know, explains this exactly based on everything that we are making it for. I'll read you, it's one line from Rav Asher Weiss. Shebiyom ze shekol kulo hester, af hilulo behester. Since the whole theme of Purim is the hidden, even the Hallel is hidden. Al ze amro, kriyasa ze hilula. It's exactly underscoring this theme again, that not only, just like we can see Hashem when he is more muted, you know, it's not, you know, even in the lighter colors, not just when Hashem is in the bright neon, flashing lights, even when Hashem is more in the pastels and in the quieter, softer colors, we have to be able to see Hashem. So too, we express our Hallel and our praise and our thanksgiving to Hashem in this more indirect, muted way, as a way of signaling to ourselves that that's the interaction with Hashem that we are specifically praising. So it's like a mida keneged mida. Hashem related to us in that hidden way on Purim, and therefore we praise Hashem in a more hidden, subtle way through the Megillah and not directly. And then we asked a third question, which was, why is it that all of a sudden Pitom on Purim, the Jewish people recommitted themselves to the Torah, as opposed to at Har Sinai, where until, you know, it was some level of coercion, and for all of those years in between, it remained status quo, which was less than perfect, until Purim, Hadar Kibluha Bimei Achashverosh. And here, I think the answer also fits in very beautifully with everything that we've been saying. Because obviously, we know from the Torah itself, and the Midrashim certainly embellish and elaborate on it, but it's already indicative in the Psukim themselves, Har Sinai wasn't just a moment of the giving of the law, of the Torah. Har Sinai was the ultimate thunder and light show, right? Awesome, like you wanted to have tickets for that. I mean, incredible miracles, you could see see thunder, hear lightning, you know, all sorts of a fire on the mountain, cloud, Moshe going up, 40 days, no food, no water. It was like, wow, amazing. But the truth of the matter is, if the only relationship you have with Hashem is the Nes Nigla, the wow miracles of Har Sinai, of the Midbar, then it's not going to be 100% perfect. Because the truth is, as they transitioned out of the Midbar, Hashem chose in his inscrutable wisdom to be retreating, to be more quiet, to be more subtle. And truth of the matter is, through much of history and now until we get to the time of the Purim story, where they're in the first Golus, right after the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash, Hashem has really gone into hiding. And the question is, can you see Hashem even in Golus? Can you only see Hashem in Har Sinai? Can you only see the Shem on the banks of the Yamsuf? Or can you even see Hashem when you're spread out in 120 plus Medinos, even when you are in the palace of Achashverosh? Is Hashem even there? And it was only at the end of the Purim story where the Jewish people of that generation, they got it. They got it, right? It's like, you know, analogous to, I would say, I'll go out on a limb, I'll say, you know, what's maybe the best example of this in modern history? The Six-Day War, right? Unfortunately, there are people, even among the Jewish people, who analyze all the events of the Six-Day War purely from the perspective of either military genius, political genius, or just dumb luck, right? We believe that all three of those took place, choreographed by Hashem. And one of the great examples of a Nes Nistar in, you know, really biblical proportions almost. That's how incredible those miracles were. But, you know, again, I don't want to go through all the details of the Six-Day War now, but you could explain them all away. Or you could say it was all Biyad Hashem. So the Jewish people at that time, in the time of Mordechai and Esther, they understood. It was all Biyad Hashem. And it was at that point, evidently, that they finally, and evidently even more than they ever had heretofore, even that they ever had before that, they finally truly saw and understand and appreciated how Hashem interacts with them, even in these less overt and less, I would say less overtly miraculous ways. Not everything is a nes nigla, like it was in the Beis HaMikdash with 10 daily miracles. Not everything is a nes nigla, like Pesach or Yetzias Mitzrayim or Har Sinai. There is a way of Hashem interacting with us on Purim. And that, once they finally got that, that was a certain shlemus. Now all of a sudden, hadar kiblua. Now we recommit ourselves. We can reconnect to the Torah because we now have a completely different and deeper dimension of our relationship with Hashem and our understanding of how He interacts with us. I want to, if I can, mention maybe one or two other points just along these lines, and then we'll conclude in a few more minutes. There is an amazing medrash. The medrash is in Esther Rabbah. That's the medrash Rabbah on Esther, which tells us about when Haman went looking for Mordechai, when he had to take him on that ride on Ahasuerus's horse, right? One of the pivotal moments in the story when things are flipping in our direction. Haman thought he's going to Ahasuerus to, you know, put the final nail in Mordechai's coffin. He didn't want to have to wait to kill him. He was ready to get him to be killed right then. And before you know it, he's leaving Ahasuerus's palace, you know, having to give great glory and kavod to Mordechai. The Medrash elaborates and says what happened. Haman went looking for Mordechai. Where did he find him? He found him teaching. And it sounds like he was teaching young children. He was teaching them Torah. Now, this is an important point. I don't know if you've thought about it or you know this, but just in case you don't, it's important to realize many of the events, including this pivotal part of the story, took place over Pesach. Eventually, the date that had been chosen for Rachmana Litzlan, the Jewish people's destruction, which, if in Ahafochu, turns into the great military victory when we defeated our enemies, that is all those months later in Adar. But much earlier, the Pesach, but for that, that's still towards the beginning of the story, that's when Mordechai went to Esther. Esther says we're going to have the 3-day fast. In fact, the Gemara tells us that one of the days of the fast was Pesach night, the Seder, and that the Rabbanim originally were like, whoa, Esther, I don't know, how can we have a fast day? It's supposed to be the Seder. We're not going to have matzah. We're not going to have a Seder. We're fasting. And Esther persuaded, just again, picture this, how incredible this is. You have this wonderful single woman telling the 70 greatest Rabbanim, you're wrong. And they agreed with her. And she persuaded them and they bowed to her. And of course, they did have the fast. And it all worked. All of that was around the time of Pesach. So according to this Medrash, when Haman went to get Ahasuerus, it was the next day, the 16th, Tet Zion Nisan. Now, what usually happens on the 16th of Nisan? So you and I probably think of, okay, what are our kids going to want us to do with them on Chol HaMoed? Right? The first day of Chol HaMoed, what are we doing? Okay, mommy, we want to go this way. You know, but my friend is going that to you. I want to go on that to you. But okay, in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, what was happening? That's when the Kohanim would bring the Karban Omer, right? Until you bring the Karban Omer on the first day of Chol HaMoed, on 16th of Nisan, all of the new grain, the new crop, is prohibited to be eaten. That's called the prohibition of Chadash. You can only eat old grain. The new grain is only mutter after the Kohanim brought the Karban HaOmer. Of course, that's where the whole mitzvah of Sviras HaOmer comes from. Right? We start counting Sviras HaOmer on the second night of Pesach. And it's called Sviras HaOmer because it begins with the same date that we bring the Karban HaOmer. Right? Now, the Karban HaOmer, according to this Medrash, is exactly what Mordechai was teaching these children. He was teaching them the laws of the Karban HaOmer, and he was even displaying real and hands-on way how a Kohen would take a special handful of barley. The Karban HaOmer is brought from barley, which is considered the lowest form of grain. Again, why it's Dafka that, not for now, that, but whatever the symbolism of that. And he's describing all that, and according to the Medrash, that's when Haman comes in looking for Mordechai. So he says, what are you guys doing? And they explain to Haman, oh, well, we're learning about the Karban HaOmer. What is it made from? What do you give? Is it some incredible thing of silver and gold? No, 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 it's grain. Oh, it must be the best grain. No, 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 it's barley. And the Medrash ends by saying very powerfully and beautifully that Haman, you know, a bitter and broken man, says, well, apparently your fistful of barley was more potent and more powerful than my 10,000 silver coins, you know, which he had bribed Ahasuerus with. Because here he's trying to kill Mordechai, and somehow he suspected, or he was able to intuit, that the zechusim of all this that Mordechai was doing was keeping him alive. Okay? That's the Medrash. A beautiful, very interesting Medrash, adding a lot of rich texture to the Megillah story. So, I saw something very beautifully from the Maharal of Prague. And he asks, why is it that it was Davka this that Haman, so to speak, stumbled on, right? There's so many things in Torah they could have been studying. Why is it Davka on that day? Why was it Davka this thing, that, this part of Torah that they were studying? And why does the Medrash, you know, so to speak, place into Haman's mouth this idea that your barley beat my silver? What deeper message? There seems to be a tremendous focus. It's hard to believe it's a coincidence. I mean, that's the whole theme of the shiur, right? That we're not, we don't believe in coincidence. Why was it Dafka, the barley? So the Maharal explained, the Maharal has a commentary on Megillas Esther called Or Chadash, on the holiday of Purim. And the Maharal there explains that the mitzvah of the Omer really has a crucial message for us. Because you have to realize, again, we're not farmers, but we can understand this, I think, on some level, that the yearly harvest is a product of an agricultural cycle. And it's very, very easy. I mean, there's no one who works harder than a farmer, right? Puts in so much effort. There's a lot of kochi v'otzem yadi for the farmer, for sure, right? Waking up very early every day for so long, you know, first plowing and then planting and then watering and then... and then waiting and waiting and waiting and hoping. And then finally the stuff, you know, where his crop grows, says the Maharal, be very, very easy for a farmer to see his job and his success as being self-sustaining, self-perpetuating, and easily, easily to ignore Hashem's guiding hand. And therefore, says the Maharal, the Torah says when it comes to taking the first harvest, the very first thing, before we can enjoy any of the new harvest. Again, you and me, that's like what we buy in the bakery. So the Mashkiach makes sure that until the first day, you know, after Pesach, all the stuff we're buying is from Yashan flour. Okay? You and I do nothing for that. We just go to a bakery with a good hashkacha. But the farmer put in so much effort and he can't enjoy any of his efforts until beforehand he gives his first grain, he gives it to the Kohanim, so to speak, symbolically, it gets offered as a carbon. And therefore, the message, says the Maharal, is a reminder, obviously to the farmers, but hopefully to all of us, that expresses our awareness that even things like the agricultural cycle, which is, you would think, so natural, so automatic, and so involved in human, is so predicated on human involvement, but even that ultimately is based on Hashem guiding and supervising and blessing our efforts in nature. That is to say, says the Maharal, to put it in the words we've been using until now, Nes Nistar. The very fact that there is an agricultural cycle, that there are somewhat predictable, so to speak, laws of nature that the farmer relies on to work and to invest. And yes, he did put in a lot of effort, for sure. He sweated, for sure. But it all comes from Hashem. That the farmer reminds himself, we all remind ourselves of that, through these gifts such as the Karban Omer. And says the Maharal, that's exactly the message of Purim. Remember, what Haman is from Amalek. And what does the Pasuk say? We read it just recently when Amalek attacks the Jewish people. Asher karcha baderech, right? Everything is mikra. Everything is a coincidence, right? How did Haman make his whole plan of a Holocaust? Right? He drew lots, right? Everything by Haman and by Amalek is chance. And says the Maharal, it's not a coincidence that the Jewish people were learning about the Karban HaOmer, because we are saying it's just the opposite. Yes, it's our barley, meaning our understanding, our belief that everything, the farming, the agricultural, that barley, it's all from Hashem. It's not by chance. And because we internalize that message, we commit ourselves. When we can bring the carbon, we bring it. And when we can't, we learn the laws and we follow them. That itself, yes, that exactly, that did beat, that was victorious over all of Haman's silver coins. And I'll conclude by mentioning one last a little vort, which I thought was very beautiful, which I also saw from Rav Asher Weiss in that same piece that I mentioned before. It's very possible that you're not as familiar with this, because I don't know, depending on shuls you've been in previous years, you may not always have the best view of the men's section at the Megillah, or depending on where you read the Megillah, and if you actually, I guess if you were just at a woman's reading afterwards, maybe you were able to see the man reading the Megillah. But either way, you might not ever have seen the actual Megillah when it's being read. Maybe you have. That's wonderful. But if you haven't, then what I'm saying is new to you. But what you should be aware of, and this is actually brought down in the Shulchan Aruch, it's a minog, but it's brought down in the Shulchan Aruch as a proper minog, that the Baal Koreh unrolls the entire Megillah before he starts reading, and then folds it over in flaps like an old-fashioned igeret, like a letter, because that's the term that's used in the Megillah, it describes the igeret. And this is very different, the Gemara points this out, it's very, very different than the way we read a Sefer Torah, right? Where basically it's all rolled, and we're slowly unrolling it section by section when we're ready to read it. We don't take out the whole Torah and then fold it over and over again, and then on Parshas Truma or Tetzaveh, you know, turn to that part. No, we're only opening the part that we're reading at that moment. That's for regular Kriyas HaTorah. But when it comes to the Megillah, we take out the whole Megillah and then we fold it over. And then, you know, the Baal Koreh has to be a little bit dexterous to each time he finishes to then fold it over and etc. Why is that necessary? Okay, it's an idea, it's a minog, it's referred to as igeres. So says Rav Asher Weiss, again, I think something so beautiful. So he quotes the language of the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch says, minog kol Yisrael, shakore kore uposhet ki igeres, that the first, before he starts even reading it, he takes out the whole Megillah. You know, it's not as long as the Sefer Torah, but it's not exactly Megillah's root either. It's longer than that, right? And he takes the whole thing out and folds it up and makes a big pile on the bima. Why does he do that, says the Shulchan Aruch? This is still the Shulchan Aruch. Laharos hanes. To show the miracle. What does that mean? Because the whole Megillah is out at the same time, you see the miracle better? I have to admit, I don't know how many times I've seen the Shulchan Aruch in my life before. I never really paid attention to it. At least I never paid attention to the last two words. Laharos hanes. What exactly does that mean? What is the point? So says Rav Asher Weiss, I think, so beautifully, that what it means is as follows. And again, I'll read, it's just one or two lines from his beautiful Hebrew. Dirak asher sokrim et kol ha-megillah, beskira achat, mitchilata ad sofa, ro'im et hashkachar Hashem, sof ma'aseh, b'machshav etchila, then ro'im et nes purim. V'lo kasher korim kol yiriya b'fnei atzmo. Says Rav Asher Weiss, this minhag, which is brought down in Shulchan Aruch, actually has deeply embedded in it a tremendous secret, a secret to success, and a key to understanding everything we've been talking about, which I think it's a perfect note on which to end this year. Says Rav Asher Weiss, when it comes to the Nes Nigla, the Kriyas Yamsus of the world, the thunder and light shows, so you don't need to have any context. You don't need a broader lens. Just seeing that is like, whoa, wow. But if you're talking about things where Hashem is playing a much quieter, subtle, orchestrative role through history, says Rav Asher Weiss, in those kind of events, most likely, you only detect the Yad Hashem when you see the big picture. Right? One thing is a coincidence. Two, I don't know. But another thing, just working out right. Each one of the events in the Megillah, we mentioned this previously, each one of the events can be explained away, either by good planning or just dumb luck. But so many events, this, then this, then this, then this, says Rav Asher Weiss, that is totally typical and predictable almost, you could say, when we're talking about a Nes Nigla. A Nes Nigla is impossible to see in isolation. I mean, you could take it on blind faith, but you don't see it in the same way you see a Nes Nigla. A Nes Nistar is hidden. That's the whole point. But if you see the whole picture, you get a broad view. Then the broader context, you're like, whoa, it comes together. And that's what we're trying to symbolize, he says, by having the whole Megillah out. And that's what the Shulchan Aruch meant when he said, Laharos Hanes. The only way you can see the miracle, truly see with your third eye, with your spiritual eye, the one that can see things even that are invisible, the one that can see and hear Hashem's voice even when your ears or your eyes can't, that spiritual eye, those spiritual ears, that is attuned to, and that's symbolized by the fact that we open up the whole Megillah. And as to say, you need a broader picture, right? You look at events just in a moment, a slice of things. Oh, this is so terrible. I don't understand this. Then you take a step back. Whoa! 70 years ago, there was no state of Israel. Look where we are now. Like, the bigger the picture, the more you can see the Yad Hashem in this hidden, Nes Nistar kind of way. I think that's unquestionably true. And what Rav Asher Weiss is saying so brilliantly and so creatively and so beautifully is that he thinks that idea is symbolized by the miracle of opening up the whole Megillah first and then unfolding it as we read it. But it's all already out there on the Bima, because you need to be able to see the big picture in order to be able to see all of the little pieces, how they actually work in concert, and how in fact they are all truly Biyad Hashem. So this, I believe, is a important message. I'm not saying it's the only message, but I think it's really a crucial message. It's not a peripheral din or just a cute little vort, you know, to say at the Purim Suda, but really a fundamental issue that gets to the heart of what Purim is about. It is the flip side, is connected to, but in many ways the opposite, the flip side of Pesach. It's the other model of Geula. It's the other model of a Nes. Not how Hashem periodically works in the Nes Nigla, breaking the laws of nature, but how Hashem so regularly in our own lives and certainly in the Jewish people's national life works through history and through nature to guide us just as much as he does when he splits the Yam Suf and does miracles like that. And that is really not easy always to see. Of course not. But that's why we have to work at it. And that's really a message that Purim is there for us to hopefully be mechazik ourselves and our children and our families, to hopefully not only see the Yad Hashem in Purim, but use Purim every year to remind ourselves to be able hopefully to see the Yad Hashem in every aspect of our lives individually, and of course, the entire nation of Am Yisrael.